Welcome to Her Story, a project by Chick History. I'm your host, Rebecca Price. For 1 year, we asked 50 contemporary women to share the story of the historical woman who has inspired her. Join us every week for a new story of inspiration, from the headliners to the lesser-known gems.
Dust off the books, read all the letters, preserve with time. Dig out the truth written between the lines. Her history cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten.
Joining us today for her story number 39 is Jennifer Redman. Jennifer is the director of the Albert M. Greenfield Digital Center for the History of Women's Education at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania. She's a Council on Libraries and Information Resources postdoctoral fellow with a joint appointment between Special Collections and the History Department there. She holds a BA from University College Dublin and a Master's of Philosophy and PhD from the School of Histories and Humanities in Trinity College Dublin, Ireland. Her research in women's social and educational history has been published in international journals and edited collections, and her first monograph on Irish women's migration history is due to be published in 2013. Jennifer is also the International Secretary of the Women's History Association of Ireland and the National Representative for Ireland to the International Federation for Research in Women's History. To learn more about Jennifer and her work, you can follow her on Twitter at RedmanJennifer. And you can visit the Digital Center's website at greenfield.brynmawr.edu, and you can follow them on Twitter at greenfieldhwe. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Rebecca.
And which woman are you going to share with us today?
I have selected Martha Carey Thomas, who's more commonly known as M. Carey Thomas, but by her own choice as Carey.
Well, please share with us a little bit about M. Carey Thomas.
M. Carey Thomas was Bryn Mawr College's first dean, its first female president, and really has been a kind of legendary figure in its history. I'll go back for a minute to tell you more about her background before moving on to talk about why I think she's such a monumental figure in the history of women's education. So Thomas was born in Baltimore in Maryland on January 2nd, 1857, to a prominent Quaker family. At this time, I think there was about 100,000 Quakers in America. So they kind of did know each other, and her family had a lot of social prominence. So from a young age, her couple of biographies written about her all document that she had a precocious talent for learning and a desire for learning too. And one of the stories that's well known about her is that as a child, she suffered a very severe burn due to pouring the contents of a boiling pot over herself. Some have identified her recovery period as a kind of a momentous period in her life, because not just from the trauma of the burn itself, which led her for a time to question her belief in God, you know, why would he let her suffer like that? But also because she spent a lot of time reading and then also having her mother read to her. And I think it's that experience that gave her the opportunity to lead the life of the mind, so to speak, something that she always aspired to throughout her life. She began her formal journey into serious study by attending the Howland Institute, which was a boarding school at Union Springs near Ithaca. And she entered that school and shared a room with her cousin, Bessie King. And the founder of that school, George Howland, and the president, Robert Howland, were both Quakers, so her parents readily agreed to her attending. And after this experience, although she was later to look back and feel she wasn't quite as prepared after it as she wanted to be, her appetite for education was definitely whetted. Although it took some time for her father to become convinced that she should be allowed to pursue her studies a bit further, there was a general attitude among some Quakers at this time that education should be put towards utility in life, and higher education for higher education's sake was not necessarily a good aim. And added to this, the fact that she was a woman created a couple of obstacles. But she was never one to let things really stop her. So after finishing at Howland, she spent some time at home before becoming convinced that Cornell, which was then building Sage College to house women students, was the next point on her educational journey. And her mother was always a champion for her in things that she wanted to do like that. It's quite striking, though, that throughout this time, while she was quite young, her letters and her diary entries all show that she had a real vision for herself. She didn't want to be educated simply to be knowledgeable. She really wanted to make a difference for women in the world. So after she finished at Cornell, she began seriously to turn her mind to graduate work that she wanted to do. And she was struggling always to make up her mind what her focus was. But her family members were involved in educational institutions, including Haverford. And her father was involved in the newly established Johns Hopkins University that launched in 1876. And that was a place that was seen as blending American educational traditions with serious doctoral and research focus of German universities, which were then seen as the kind of pinnacle of higher education research institutions. So Johns Hopkins had said that women would be considered for entry on a case-by-case basis. And having known about some women who succeeded in gaining entry, she pushed ahead and became a student herself. Now, this could have possibly been the end of her academic journey, but it wasn't, because when she was there, she found that she was excluded from many of the seminars she wanted to go to. And eventually she ended up withdrawing from the college without achieving her degree. She felt really that without the proper academic support of lectures and time with the professors, she simply couldn't achieve it. And she was very disappointed in herself because, as I said, she had this vision of herself striving not only for her own education, but to become a pioneer for other women. But she didn't give up her thoughts on gaining graduate education. So after a time at home, she decided to go to Europe. And again, she had a challenging experience in some of the lectures in the German university she chose to go to. For example, male students tried to stare her and her friend Mamie Gwynn out of the room. She found them a bit raucous at times. She did do the work for her doctoral degree. The university would not award her the degree because she was a woman. So she found again another way and went to the University of Zurich to be examined, where she got her doctorate and she graduated summa cum laude, which was an astonishing achievement for women at this time. And in fact, I believe she was the only foreigner to achieve this status as well. So she was therefore finally confident in her abilities as a scholar, and she really wanted to pursue a life as an academic. And as I said before, her family were always involved in different higher education institutions, particularly those that had Quaker influence. And she had heard about this new college, Bryn Mawr, which was being built at that time. And she launched her bid to become involved. And we have a wonderful letter where she lays out her qualifications and why she believes that as a woman, she would be most suitable to head up a women's college. She wasn't successful in becoming the president, but she did become the dean, which was a new position in American higher education institutions, but it was a bit of a catch-all post. She did a lot of work recruiting faculty, shaping the curriculum, and I think it's the main reason why her stamp was seen on so many things across the college. But she worked well with the president, Charles Rhodes, in this new position, and when he died, she became the first female president of the college and went to work more seriously in shaping the college, which she wanted to be an exemplary institution for women, one that stressed high academic achievement, that privileged those goals over the original goals of it being a Quaker institution for Quakers. And she really kind of extended the boundaries of what it had been. Another thing to mention to her about her then in this regard is that her family members were devout Quakers in Baltimore, as I've said, and both her father and her uncle had been chosen for the board of Bryn Mawr College because they were Quakers. But as some people might know about her, she wasn't herself devout in her adult life. She struggled with what she saw as the narrow confines of her faith, particularly because she was a great lover of poetry and theatre and art, things that in some Quaker circles were frowned upon as a distraction and not the proper focus of people's lives. So when she sought a position at the college, she did stress her Orthodox background, you know, undoubtedly to appeal to some of the more conservative members of the board, but she also stressed her excellent academic achievements. And this is something she built upon, but came away from the former part of it, the religious part of it. And she wrote in 1897 to her friend Mary Garrett that at the time of her making her bid to become involved in Bryn Mawr, she said the college was such a lottery and the conditions were so unfavorable and the chances so small of making anything but the narrowest sectarian school that I went there with utmost reluctance. And when she did finally attain the position of president in 1894, she had to tread a careful line in maintaining this kind of outward appearance of conformity while progressing her own agenda for women's education at the college and the pursuit of academic excellence in a more modern tradition of education. And at times then, Carey Thomas's vision for Bryn Mawr clashed with that of, as I said, the more conservative members of the board. But in a strange twist of fate, this later worked in her favor. There was a man called John Garrett, an Orthodox Quaker, and he resigned from the board in 1902 in protest over a student production of Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore, which they put on to raise money for a library and improvements to the heating and power system in the college. But this protest and this resignation gave Carey Thomas the opportunity to nominate herself as a trustee, something she had wanted from the beginning of her tenure as president to really kind of solidify her position, but it had been denied. But this time she was successful, and it really demonstrated how far she had come in establishing her role at Bryn Mawr and her status internationally as an expert on women's education.
And what about M. Carey Thomas do you find to be so inspirational?
Well, I really like the fact that she found intelligent, witty, and calm ways to speak back to those who wrote or preached negatively about women's education. And as you know, at this time, 19th century, there were many people such as Edward Clarke who said things such as serious study will significantly disable women, they will be sterile, and those kinds of things. And there was another detractor she found in the person of Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard. He gave a speech on women's colleges at the inauguration of President Caroline Hazard at Wellesley College in 1899, kind of an inappropriate moment, I think, to make the comments that he did. But in this speech, Eliot started by comparing men's and women's colleges. And at first, he created this kind of rhetorical distance between his own views and those which he attributed to a wider society. But I think you can tell where his real opinion lies. He stated that while colleges for men are held by most intelligent persons to be necessary to the welfare of society, the colleges for women are still regarded by many people as luxuries or superfluities, which some rather peculiar well-to-do girls desire to avail themselves of, and by others as means of increasing the earning power of a few exceptional girls who must earn their livelihood. The public and most parents regard the college education of a young man as a solid investment, but have no such view of the advanced education of women. And this idea that particularly the first generation of women going to college were in some way queer or peculiar or strange or exceptional geniuses, on the other hand, was one that was perpetuated in some ways to keep further generations of women out. And this naturally angered Thomas. But again, I will go back to the fact that she found really kind of intelligent and witty ways to speak back. So referring to Eliot's speech in her own opening address to Bryn Mawr College that year, she wryly observed that such attitudes only show us that as progressive as one may be in education or other things, there may be in his mind some dark spot of medievalism, and clearly in President Eliot's otherwise luminous intelligence, women's education is this dark spot. And I like that kind of style that she had. She didn't display anger, which in some ways would have negated her point to her detractors. She found a way to play him at his own game by praising the innovations he had made in Harvard, but by pointing out that he was slightly medieval in his social attitudes. Another thing I admire about her is that we've been studying Thomas and her life as part of the class I teach on the history of women's education. And it became very clear just this week that her personal experiences of trying to be a scholar still really resonate with young women undergraduates who are trying to complete their degrees, often feeling overburdened and overwhelmed by the work it takes to do this, and plagued almost by the question of what next. And I think finding connections between the past and the present is certainly the thing I'm most interested in history. I feel like she is a good example of that. And finally, I would say that I admire Thomas's drive and her ability to forge forward into what was then unknown territory. She really yearned to be a scholar and to make a reputation for herself and to feel the respect and status in society that came with that. Yet, as Helen Horowitz, her biographer, has observed, Thomas had no corporeal models, no living women to show her how to become what she wanted to be, no actual person to convince her when she doubted that she could develop her mind and emerge as a scholar. And so, to a large degree, therefore, Thomas and other pioneers in education were self-invented phenomenon, and yet we all need role models. And I do stress that in my class because I feel that in my life. And to me, she's a role model.
And what one book would you recommend to listeners so that they can start learning more about her?
The essential book really to read is by Helen Lefkowitz Horowitz called The Power and the Passion of M. Carey Thomas. It's published by Johns Hopkins. Horowitz is actually a member of the advisory board for the Albert M. Greenfield Digital Center for the History of Women's Education. And she has, I know from personal experience, really amazing insights on both the broader history of women's education and on Thomas herself. It's really a powerful critical biography.
Well, there you have it for M. Carey Thomas. Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing her story with us.
Thank you so much.
To learn more about her story and other projects by Chick History, you can visit the website chickhistory.com. And please join us every week for another story of an inspirational woman in history.
I'm here to tell a story, something precious and fine, about a woman who made a difference with her life. She might not be known, but to only a few, her story remembered here is gonna change that view. Her history cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten. Her story not forgotten.